Beloved listeners, when I was young, I used to stay at the St. Regis in New York City, not far from Central Park, and there, from time to time, I'd see the problematic Salvador Dali drift through the foyer. That's, I guess, my closest personal contact with the surrealism movement, which turns 100 this year. Now, we thought long and hard about how to celebrate its centennial. For example, what about melting the studio clock or replacing my microphone with a lobster? Instead, we've decided to roll out the red carpet for a special surrealist guest in Mark Polizzotti. Mark is not only the publisher and editor-in-chief at the Mighty Met, the Metropolitan Museum in New York. He's also a very prolific writer. He's translated over 50 books and written many of his own, and I'm delighted he can join us from the Big Apple to talk about his latest effort, Why Surrealism Matters. Mark, welcome to our little wireless program in the Antipodes.
Thank you very much, Philip. I'm delighted to be here.
It's hard to imagine a movement that's given us such random objects as melting clocks and lobster phones having had an organized beginning. But it is possible to pinpoint the actual birth?
Yes, well, I'll give you an appropriately surrealist answer to that. Yes and no. Yes, in that the Surrealist movement officially began in the fall of 1924, in October 1924 in Paris, with the publication of André Breton's Manifesto of Surrealism and several other events surrounding it. But as Breton was very quick to point out in the manifesto, the spirit that we call surrealist, the mindset of surrealism, had existed well before this. One could even say since the dawning of human consciousness in every age and in every country.
But he cites the likes of de Sade and Edgar Allan Poe, doesn't he?
He lists a number of predecessors, Sade, Edgar Allan Poe, Swift, and even Shakespeare and Dante. And what he was really aiming at was, in a nutshell, a fusion of dream and waking reality, which he called a kind of an absolute reality or surreality. And what this was meant to express was a sense of wonder, a sense of marvel that he felt had been lost by centuries of Greco-Roman logic conditioning. You know, France at that time was a very rational place. That, you know, of course, it was a very Cartesian place. And Breton felt that this was one of the sources of all evil. And so what he was looking for was an antidote to that.
Mark, who actually coined the term?
The term surrealism was coined by the poet Guillaume Apollinaire, who was the of the generation before Breton's and had actually been Breton's mentor when he was a very young man. Apollinaire is famous for a collection called Alcool, which he published in 1913. And he coined the term surrealism only because he didn't want to use superrealism, which was already used. But he meant it in a very different sense. He meant it as a kind of poetic analogy. Breton was taking, when he employed the term surrealism several years later, he meant it in a much more scientific sense. He defined it as the absolute, the actual functioning of thought. So he was looking at it from a you can almost say, a psychological or philosophical point of view.
There's a great quote from Apollinaire that you include. When man tried to imitate walking, he created the wheel, which does not resemble a leg. He was thus performing an act of surrealism without realizing it. Wonderful.
Absolutely. And as I mentioned in the book, there were several. Now, Apollinaire was dead by the time surrealism started. He died at the very end of World War One, partly of the Spanish flu. But several of his followers, younger poets, had taken up the cause of surrealism in his name. And it led to this a kind of a copyright battle in the fall of 1924 between these two warring factions who were each claiming the right to use the word surrealism in completely different ways and disputing the other person's right to use it. And ultimately, this ended up getting played out in the press with all kinds of squabbles back and forth. And ultimately, if Breton and his group won, it's because the manifesto was just simply better writing.
Now, Mark, he seems to be an improbable person to launch a movement like this because he lacked flamboyance or eccentricity, although you make the point that he had charisma.
Yeah, I mean, the popular view of surrealism is sort of all party all the time. And in fact, it really wasn't that. There were some in the movement who would fit that profile. Breton himself did not. He had a very regular lifestyle, fairly quiet. He lived at the same address for his entire adult life. He was not into parties. He was not into drugs. He didn't like dancing. He didn't like music. He didn't like nightclubs. He even had the same handwriting for his entire life, which is extremely rare. But he also had a very unorthodox and adventurous mind, and he was interested in all kinds of things that were not at all part of the mainstream. He was one of the first people to become interested in contemporary movements like Cubism, just when this was starting out. He was one of the first people to become interested in what we now call indigenous art. His first acquisition when he was 15 years old was to buy a fetish object from Easter Island that he bought off a returning sailor with his school prize money, much to the dismay of his parents. So he was looking at things that were not at all part of the mainstream, but you wouldn't know it by looking at him because he seemed to be so buttoned down. But as you mentioned, he also had great personal charm, personal charisma, and everyone said that talking to him, you felt like the most important person in the world. And I think it was that combination of charisma and also the seriousness of purpose that he brought to surrealism that allowed it to last for, as an organized movement, for nearly 50 years. Whereas some of the other figures in the group, like Antonin Artaud or Robert Desnos or some of the others who might seem a little bit more in keeping with the lifestyle, they flamed out or went insane or were committed to an asylum or committed suicide. You know, it took someone who was a bit more sober, I think, to be able to pull all the strands together and keep everyone motivated.
And yet clearly he'd been profoundly affected, perhaps traumatized by his experiences in World War I.
Absolutely. Yeah, he and many of his generation, of course, had served in the war. Breton had been a medical student when the war broke out, so he served as a medical orderly. But he saw, his fair share of combat, and he, like many others, was absolutely repulsed by the war, by the butchery of it, and again, considered that the rationalist society of France and of Europe was what had made this possible, what had led to it. There was also, during the war, the example of the Dada movement, which started in Zurich in 1916 and was the product of a number of refugees who had fled to Switzerland because they did not want to participate in the war, and had created this movement. It was based on a flagrant irrationalism and flouting any sort of rational convention. And this was also a thrilling example for Breton. So that was something that he came across during the war that was important for the founding of surrealism.
He also had to deal with soldiers suffering shell shock. And
right.
You make the point that he adopted Freudian principles to treat them.
And that was the other thing, is that in his work as a medical orderly, he came across the writings of Freud, which were just starting to be translated into French, and also studied under several physicians who were beginning to adapt or become interested in psychoanalytic theory. And he himself, as part of his duties, treated shell shock patients. One of the techniques that they used was automatic speech, for them to just sort of speak at will without any conscious control. And he was absolutely fascinated by this because he said, as a young poet, he would be hearing these phrases coming out and thought, there's nothing I can write or my friends can write that can touch this. The automatic writing, the first automatic text and the first surrealist text actually predates the manifesto by 5 years. It's a book called The Magnetic Fields, and it was co-written by Breton and another young poet, Philippe Soupeau, one of the early surrealists, in 1919. And this came directly out of Breton's experiences during the war, treating shell shock patients. He wanted to try this out for himself. And he and Soupeau spent a week in a hotel room, sitting there, just writing. And sometimes it would be, just themselves. Sometimes they would pass papers back and forth. And at the end of the day, they would read what they had read. And he said they would just burst out laughing because they couldn't believe what it was that they'd come up with. Several years later, in 1922, they tried another version of this when one of the members brought the technique of hypnosis, sleep seances. And what this was people basically would go under hypnosis, a little bit like a seance, and just start to recount the most incredible stories. Again, kind of, you know, tapping into the unconscious and spewing out these stories with no particular conscious control, with no logic to them necessarily, and yet they were absolutely transfixed. And they would take all kinds of forms. And sometimes it would be not just speaking. Sometimes, you know, people would start to bark like a dog and eat out of the animal's dish, or things like that. But the problem with these was after a while, they became so intense that they also turned rather violent. And there were instances where, for example, one person was chasing another one around the lawn with a carving knife. So at a certain point, Breton had to put a stop to these experiments.
That had attracted a very distinguished alumni, hadn't it? Like Man Ray?
Absolutely. The list of people, I mean, you mentioned Dali, Man Ray, Marcel Duchamp was never an actual member, but he was very close to them. Louis Bunuel, I mean, you can go on and on and on. Paul Éluard, Louis Aragon, I mean, there are huge numbers of people who were involved in some way, shape, or form with the Surrealist group. And even Picasso, who was, again, never a member per se, was very much a fellow traveler at a certain point.
I hadn't realized that Bunuel was also drawn into this orbit.
Absolutely. Bunuel's first film, The Andalusian Dog, was co-made with Dali. The two of them co-wrote it. And it was their entry into the Surrealist group in 1929.
With one of the most notorious close-up images in the history of cinema.
So the film starts with a woman on a balcony and a man behind her looking at the moon. And as you watch the moon, a cloud starts to move across it. And just at that moment, the film cuts to a close-up of the woman's eye and the razor slicing the eye.
This is a little wireless program suitable only for adults. It's called Late Night Live. And I'm chatting to Mark Polizotti about his brilliant new book, Why Surrealism Matters. Now, you draw some interesting parallels between the world of surrealism and the world in which we live today. Do you think 100 years on that surrealism is still relevant?
I think it is. I think it is. You know, one of the things that really struck me, and one of the reasons I was moved to start to write this book, was that I began to notice that the world in which they lived and the world in which we live are sharing a number of the same issues and the same problems. For example, you know, the issues of social and racial injustice, of economic inequality, of environmental devastation, the specter of war. They just came out of World War I. We're facing the possibility of war right now, or there are wars going on, and we're facing the possibility of them becoming even wider. You know, all of these things, opposition to colonialism, opposition to racism, opposition to the military, skepticism about work. You know, we recently heard about the Great Resignation in the wake of the pandemic. You know, they themselves were very anti-work and not quiet about it. So many points on which what the Surrealists were talking about and what people are talking about today seem to have points in common. And, you know, it's true that it's 100 years, the 100th anniversary is this year. So, of course, there's always attention paid on that basis alone. But I kept noticing that there just seemed to be more and more and more attention being paid to surrealism as a movement in terms of exhibitions, in terms of writings, in terms of articles. You know, it's a word that keeps coming back, and it's a thought that keeps coming back. And I thought it's more than just the anniversary at work here. I think people are recognizing that Surrealism, at its core, was a way of looking at the world. And it's not so much about the answers it can provide, it's about how it frames the questions that I think people are finding very relevant to the world today.
And you make the very persuasive point that it has had a huge and is continuing to have a huge influence on popular culture. I'd cite The Goon Show, the Python films, or David Lynch.
David Lynch, Theater of the Absurd, certain kinds of humor. I mean, I you know, you can't turn on television today without seeing comedy shows that are directly coming from surrealism. What we consider humor today is very much what they called black humor, or what we would call dark humor, which is a kind of humor that is you know, it's not jolly. It's fairly biting. It's a little bit cruel. It's on the dark side. It recognizes the absurdity of life. And this is very much something that was part and parcel of the surrealist mindset as well. It's become so infused in culture today that we don't even notice it anymore.
In your book, you explore how the surrealist movement went beyond art and literature to political activism. Later, mm-hmm. I want to talk about Dali's dalliance with the swastika. But tell me about the relationship with the Communist Party.
Yeah. So early on, by which I mean really the year following the founding of surrealism in 1925, they were the group was moved by several things. One, the thought that automatic writing and sleep seances and all these things were all well and good, but if you really wanted to try to make an impact in the world, you needed more direct action. And so they turned to politics. The other thing that that motivated them was, not long after World War I had ended, France was involved in various skirmishes in North Africa, which they, these colonial wars in North Africa that the surrealists were absolutely horrified by. And they thought, well, here we go again. So they became somewhat radicalized and they made overtures to join the Communist Party, which in France had really only formed several years earlier. It was, it was a very new party. It had split off from the socialists and was also trying to find its way. It was very much taking its direction from the Soviet Union. And the surrealists had a, to be frank, they had a very romanticized view of what communism was. They saw it as a kind of a continuation of the French Revolution or the Paris Commune of 1871, which already had these kind of associations for them that were political but literary as well. Nonetheless, their feeling was that they had something to bring to the table and that a fusion or a collaboration between surrealism and communism could really not only topple the reigning bourgeois order, but build something that was actually worthwhile.
But the communists did not return the compliment. They tended to view the surrealists very, very dismissively.
Yes. Well, the communists, of course, were politicians, which the surrealists were not. And many of them came from a fairly working class background. They were much more concerned with basics, how do you put food on the table, working conditions, wages, making sure that someone didn't get mangled in a factory because there were no safety provisions, that kind of thing, all very important. And the surrealists recognized the importance of it as well. The real difference came when the communists basically said, we have to stage the revolution. Then we can worry about things like avant-garde literature and, the revolution of the mind and all of that. The surrealists saw it the other way around. They said, no, you have to change the way people think first, because otherwise all you're going to end up doing is replacing one power structure with another. So, it might be the dictatorship of the proletariat versus the dictatorship of the bourgeoisie, but ultimately it's the same dictatorship, and that doesn't get you anywhere.
Now, one of the most fascinating chapters in your book looks at how surrealism spread from France to other countries. How did it become an international phenomenon?
Well, the first thing is that Paris was, of course, a great cultural center in the 20s and 30s. Everybody was coming to Paris. So, one of the things is that you would come there, and it was not hard to hear about or even to make contact with this crazy surrealist group that everyone was talking about. Also, surrealism from the very beginning welcomed people of many nationalities. I mean, you mentioned Man Ray before as American. You had people from Spain, Dali, Buñuel, Miró, people from the United Kingdom, people from Belgium. There was a very strong Belgian surrealist group went on. Czechoslovakia, Romania, Tristan Zara, who had been the lead person in Dada and came over to the surrealists, was Romanian. So you had an international grouping to begin with. And then you had a number of visitors who came and either stayed for a while and brought it back home or spread the word in some other way. And the surrealists themselves were ambassadors. So, for example, Breton and Paul Éluard traveled to Prague in 1935 and did a whole tour, essentially, a bunch of speeches, talks. Their works were translated into Czech. They did the effort. They made the effort to spread the word. They went to London for the 1936 London Surrealist Exhibition. He went to the Canary Islands. He went to Mexico. Benjamin Perret, who was another a poet of the group went to Spain. So, you know, they did what they needed to get the word out there. But I think the word itself was exciting enough that when people heard about it, they brought it back home. And what's interesting about the way Surrealism traveled is that it then got adapted to the various cultures so that, you know, Japanese Surrealism was not the same as Parisian Surrealism, and Spanish Surrealism was not the same, and Latin American Surrealism or Middle Eastern Surrealism even was not the same. They sort of took bits and pieces of the Surrealist message and adapted it to what made sense for their own cultures.
I am astonished to learn from you that there was even an Egyptian Surrealism. Now,
there was an Egyptian Surrealism.
We can't go on about Surrealism without addressing, and here's a Surrealistic image, the elephant in the room. And I talked about Salvador Dali in introducing you. Tell the sad story of Dali.
Well, you know, Dali was one of the most creative minds that ever came through the movement. Very important. I mean, I think it's important to recognize that he contributed a lot to Surrealism. He was responsible for some of its best known artworks, obviously the melting watches, the persistence of memory, the lobster telephone, various others. As I mentioned before, he made some of the first Surrealist movies with the Buñuel films. He inspired the wave of Surrealist objects that they created in the 1930s. He was the instigator of this criticism called paranoia criticism, which is a way of looking at art and of writing. He was constantly coming up with all kinds of things. He was a very flamboyant personality, as you know. So he was also good copy, which was not bad for the advertising. And the other thing is that he was very funny. I mean, he was one of the few people who could really make Breton laugh. And that counted for something.
But the sad thing was that Dali and the dollar were infatuated with each other.
Well, Dali was a power monger. He was very ambitious, and he, by his own admission in his autobiography, came to Surrealism in 1929, partly to take it over. And he was also very pro-Catholic, which, of course, the staunchly anti-clerical Surrealist did not like. He was very much fond of money, as you say. Breton had a nickname for him, which was an anagram of his name, Avida Dollars, and which Dali said was the only clever thing he ever said. There was a real rivalry between them, as well as a fascination. And then, of course, one of the things that really nailed the coffin was that Dali was fascinated by fascism and by Hitler. Now, I don't know that he himself was necessarily a fascist, Dali, although one could easily see it. But he had this absolute fascination with Hitler, with the physical reality of Hitler, with the personality of Hitler. And at a certain point, Breton said, you know, we can't have this. And there was an attempt to drum him out in the mid-1930s, but Dali was such a slippery character and such a master of humor that he made the entire thing just fall into a farce. But finally, by the end of the 30s, he was kicked out. They couldn't
well,
deal with him anymore.
This was after he'd painted Enigma of Hitler, and Breton sacks him.
Yes, that was when he became more and more fascinated with Hitler, and World War II was fast approaching. It just was no longer funny.
I think there is hard evidence that Dali was an anti-Semite.
He was a racist. Yes.
Okay, well, moving on. Throughout your book, you're keen to stress that Surrealism wasn't just a bunch of white blokes sitting around a cafe table in Paris, or indeed a Spaniard who wore crustaceans as headgear. There were all sorts of lesser-known Surrealists, and I found the most delightful aspect of your book that you introduce us to a great many of them, including the American Ted Jones.
One of the challenges I faced in the book, and we've been talking about Breton a lot, and one of the challenges I faced is that he's such a major figure and he's such a magnetic pole. It's hard to get away from him. But the reality is that Surrealism was very much a collective movement, and it was conceived as such really from the start. And many of the things that the group produced would not have made sense had they been done by a single person. They made sense as collectives, whether it was the group shows that they put together, whether it was the collaborative works that they did, whether it was, you know, the famous game of Exquisite Corpse, in which you have, a paper folded into four and four different people contribute a quarter of it without seeing what the other people have done. All these things are group or collective activities. And so the and the conversations, you mentioned sitting around a cafe table. Well, the cafe meeting, the daily cafe meeting, was very much part of the group activity. It wasn't just sitting back and knocking back a beer. It was considered to be one of the essential activities of the Surrealist group, as much as the writing, the painting, or anything else that they did, because this was where the ideas really got shared, and this is where the thoughts really bloomed and blossomed. And you know, to do that, you need to have people. You need to have a group. And so, yes, there were a number of people who passed through the movement who are not particularly well known necessarily outside of, you know, surrealism studies. René Crevel being one of them, wonderful poet, who was the one who introduced the sleep sessions back in the 20s, and sadly committed suicide in the 1930s. Robert Desnos, who was also a poet, and also one of the people who was heavily involved in the sleep sessions, unfortunately died in a concentration camp. Claude Cahun, who was, to me, one of the most interesting people. She or they was an early example of gender fluidity. She was a photographer, in part. And one of the things that she did was a series of self-portraits in which you really can't tell whether this is a man or a woman. You know, she kind of fluctuated back and forth between the two. And in fact, the name Claude Cahun, which is not her real name, is a man's name. Ted Jones is interesting. He was an American hipster, one of the few black members of Surrealism. He was a jazz fanatic, was involved with the Black Power movement, very much believed that the origin of civilization was Africa, and that Africa was the surrealist country par excellence, according to him. He became involved in the group because he happened to be in Paris in the early 60s and met Breton, and just the two of them hit it off, and he brought a completely different accent to, you know, music was not a big piece of surrealism, and Ted Jones came along with this whole love of jazz that he sort of brought to it.
Let's go from gender fluidity to the role of women in surrealism. Mm-hmm. Were they limited to being wives and muses?
No, not at all. The role of women is it's a thorny problem in surrealism. Some women felt that surrealism was very liberating for them. Others, and I had when I wrote my biography of André Breton, I was able to meet Leonora Carrington, wonderful painter, the English painter, who said to me that surrealism was just another bullshit role for women, as far as she was concerned. It really went all over the place. There was the British surrealist Etelle Colhoun, who was thrown out of the movement by the men because she was interested in witchcraft, which they considered to be inappropriate, even though it was just one more manifestation of the unconscious and of irrationality, which they were interested in. But then you had others like Merritt Oppenheim, who created probably the other most famous surrealist object, which is the fur-covered cup and saucer, who said that, you know, she felt empowered by her association with the movement. And, you know, she didn't stay forever. She stayed for a while and then left and went off to do her own things. But, you know, many, many women felt that on the one hand, yes, it could be something of a boys' club. Yes, it could feel sort of intimidating. But it also offered them a number of choices, life choices, that they did not have otherwise, that they would not have had in France or in Illinois or, you know, in wherever they came from. So it's, you know, it's tricky.
Mark, you gave us approximate date, a birth date. Can you give me a death date?
Well, again, the Paris movement officially died in 1969, was disbanded, which was 3 years after Breton's death, when they realized that, you know, we mentioned his charisma before. Without that, the group was just beginning to splinter apart. And at a certain point, they realized that, you know, they couldn't hold it together. The other thing that was the death knell was May 68. Because May 68, paradoxically, was surrealism in the streets. This was everything that they had been calling for. You know, the celebration of irrationality, taking it down to the out of the cafe and into the street itself. Many of the slogans that were scrawled on the walls of the Sorbonne were actual quotes from surrealist writings from 40 years before. But at the same time, they realized that they had been passed by, you know, and a number of the older surrealists went down to join in with the students. And the students basically said, you know, thanks, Grandpa, but we got it covered here. You know, they weren't needed anymore. The message had been passed on. So they disbanded the group in 1969. But I think it's also important to remember that, you know, as I was saying before, just that there's no official beginning to the surrealist spirit, there's no ending to it either. And it goes on today.
Mark, thank you for being such a brilliant guest and for writing such a wonderful book. My guest has been Mark Polizzotti, and he's publisher and editor-in-chief at The Met in New York, and his latest book is Why Surrealism Matters, and it's published by Yale University Press. Thanks, Mark.
Thank you so much, Philip.
Find more great ABC RN stories that take you beyond the headlines on the ABC Listen app.